To my immediate right, we have Rich Coglianese, Principal Assistant Attorney General, Office of the Ohio Attorney General. Rich started working with the Ohio Attorney General's Office in 1996 in the Crime Victim Services and Employment Law sections. Rich transferred to the Constitutional Offices section of the office in 2003 and began representing the Ohio Secretary of State. To his right, we have Ned Foley, Professor of Law, Director of Elections Law at Moritz College of Law. Ned Foley is the Robert M. Duncan Jones Day Designated Professor in Law at Moritz College and has been the Director of the Elections Law at Moritz since its inception in 2004. To his right, we have Danita Judge, Staff Attorney with the Advancement Project. Danita has been a member of the Advancement Project's Power and Democracy team since 2004 and has been Advancement Project's State Lead Attorney covering Ohio. And last but certainly not least, we have Dr. Norman Robbins from the Greater Cleveland Voter Coalition. In addition to all of his activism, Dr. Robbins is an invited member of the search team for the director of the Cuyahoga County Board of Elections in 2007, invited member of the Advisory Council to our own Voting Rights Institute, and an invited member of the National Voting Rights Act leadership team here at the Secretary of State's office. And with that, I'd like to ask each of them to open it up with a few comments. Rich.
Thanks. First of all, Jim, I want to thank you, the Secretary, for inviting me to participate in this very important topic. As Mr. Hardy has told everybody, I am with the Attorney General's office. I've been doing elections litigation for 5 years because we have various... Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks. Because of the fact that we have several cases pending, including provisional ballot cases, I'm going to be a little bit limited in what I can and cannot say today. Obviously, I'm not really going to be in a position to be able to express my beliefs as to whether or not certain proposed changes may be a good or bad thing, since any possible proposed changes may well result in future litigation. But as we're talking about this, I do want to kind of keep in mind a couple of different issues, the first of which is, in order to talk about where we're going, we really need to quickly do take a look at where we've been, especially with provisional ballots. Folks remember back, you know, back before provisional ballots, if somebody went to a polling location and they weren't on the books, that was the end of the story. The poll workers were informed to tell the person that they were not registered to vote, they were not given a ballot, they were sent home. So provisional ballots did change that and did give folks a way to vote, albeit obviously provisionally. So from that aspect, the ballots themselves did help enfranchise folks. The question that everybody in this room really no doubt wants to talk about is it an effective enfranchisement, and are we counting, are we using too many of them, are we counting them properly? But, you know, we do need to kind of keep that in mind as one of the underlying areas that we're talking about. The other thing, too, I think is important for us to keep in mind with not just provisional ballots, but with everything that we're talking about is, are solutions practical? Poll workers are at the heart of the system. Poll workers have to do whatever the law says, whatever court orders say, so that we need to make sure that anything that we put together, be it in this room today, be it in legislation that may eventually be proposed or enacted, be it in court orders, as I'm in front of judges on occasion saying, is the system that we're talking about something that the poll workers themselves are going to be able to understand and implement? Because if, in theory, we have the greatest solution to a problem, but it's something our poll workers can't do, or is difficult for them to do, or is encumbersome for them to do, the solution is going to fail. So as we're talking, I think those are two things that we really should keep in mind.
Great. Can you all hear me back there? I'm going to not repeat things that I said at the, you know, the back in December, but if there are questions that come up that cause for going over those grounds, I'd be happy to do that. You know, one thing that's happened since December is, I know that Secretary of State Ritchie was the keynote here, and Those of us who have been looking at Minnesota can learn some lessons from Minnesota. And one lesson is, I'm also a lawyer. I'm not a litigator, thank goodness. I don't have to actually do the work that Rich does, but I study the litigation. And so what I'm afraid of is Ohio getting the kinds of lawsuits and kinds of legal claims that Minnesota has gotten and has suffered from. Now, they've gotten it in the context of absentee ballots, but the data that has been released and generated in this report since December, and I think there's a lot of incredibly good data work in this document, has a warning sign that I want to point out to you, and a lawsuit that could be brought that I hope that we can figure out a way to avoid. The first thing I do want to commend the Secretary of State and the Secretary of State's office for generating this data and creating this data. We cannot improve the system and understand the system without this kind of numerical information, both in its raw form and then to analyze it. And that is the first step in the right direction. It doesn't occur in other states, in all other states, and so we just have to be very happy that is occurring here. Unfortunately, the data doesn't always tell a good news story. And one piece of data that arrived last week in time for this report that jumps out to me, I just want to share with you. And it's the data that concerns the rejection of provisional ballots on the grounds that the voter did not have appropriate identification. It's one of the categories for rejecting a provisional ballot that's indicated in the appendix. And I just want to share some differences in numbers to illustrate the point. So Hamilton County rejected zero provisional ballots for failure to provide an acceptable identification. Franklin County rejected 585 ballots for that reason. What explains that difference? Lucas County rejected 3. Cuyahoga rejected 29. Those are big population counties, and you're seeing disparities with respect to rejecting for this reason. Then it turns out that there are smaller counties that are rejecting, just in absolute terms, forget percentage terms, but absolute terms, much larger numbers of provisional ballots for this reason. Lawrence County rejects 137 provisional ballots for this reason. Portage County rejects 112 ballots for this reason. Again, compared to Hamilton, 0, Lucas, 3. I don't know what the explanation for that is. I think that's something that we want to understand. The law professor in me is concerned about a lawsuit. That kind of county-by-county variation in the rejection of ballots is precisely the claim that is in front of the three-judge court in Minnesota that there hasn't been a ruling on. It happens to be absentee ballots. It's provisional ballots here. It's the same Equal Protection Clause of the Constitution. It's the same concept of similarly situated ballots getting similar treatment. And those numbers cry out for an explanation. So I think that's just one important piece of evidence that this good work of this conference is allowing us to explore. The second data point that I'll stop to get the conversation going is with respect to every single provisional ballot that ultimately gets counted, we want to ask, could that have been a regular ballot cast and counted in the regular way? Was it necessary to have that ballot be voted provisionally? The answer is sometimes going to be yes, but perhaps in other times, no. And I think we just want to look at that. I think we then want to ask the question is, what is the disenfranchising effect of provisional ballots? If it turns out all provisional ballots get counted anyway, maybe the only problem is delay and confusion. And those are problems, we can talk about those. But is it possible, one of the allegations about provisional ballots is that they have a a disenfranchising effect that they weren't intended to have. They were supposed to be insurance policies. They were supposed to be safety nets to protect voters. What if it turns out that they have a disenfranchising effect? So based on the raw material in this report that was generated by the political scientist David Kimball, who is part of this conference, but I think in a different session at the moment, I asked him to run some numbers, which basically is a multiplication exercise. If you take the rate at which provisional ballots are voted or cast, so what percentage of all ballots are provisional in nature, and you multiply that statistic by the percentage of provisional ballots that are rejected, you get what I would characterize as the disenfranchisement rate caused by provisional voting, or the provisional voting disenfranchisement rate. So you don't have that in the report, but David was kind enough to email me some number crunching that he did based on the raw material in the report. And it turns out that quite startlingly, unfortunately, Ohio has a rather high rate at which voters are disenfranchised as a result of provisional voting. So for 2006, for which the only nationwide comparison is available, our disenfranchisement rate is over three times the national average and is one of the five highest disenfranchising rates in the country. And in 2008, we can do a couple of state-by-state comparisons. We can compare to Florida, another swing state, or Missouri, another swing state. It turns out that our disenfranchisement rate is three times Florida, three times Missouri. So that's a troublesome, again, I don't know what the explanation for that is, but it's a warning sign. It's something that calls for more investigation, but I think it raises the concern that the problem with provisional ballots is not simply timing, not simply administration, but at least as it's operationalized in Ohio, it may have a disenfranchising consequence that isn't occurring elsewhere in the country that we want to be concerned about.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'd also like to thank the Secretary of State for convening this conference and really trying to bring us all together to develop some type of consensus with regards to some of the election reform that we hope to be able to move forward in Ohio, particularly provisional ballot reform. Just to give you a little background about the type of work that I do, I'm a voter protection attorney, and I've covered Ohio since 2004. In 2004 was the first time that we really saw the provisional ballots that were basically as a result of the Help America Vote of 2002. There had certainly been provisional ballots in the state cast before, but this was the first time that they were going to be mandated under federal law by the Help America Vote Act. 2004 was troubling, but 2006 was even more troubling because what we saw at that point was the escalation. And I know that many people will argue with regards to, well, you know, at least we're casting those provisional ballots or people are voting where they didn't have an opportunity to vote before. The only thing I would say, and I will agree with Ned, is that, you know, take a look at Minnesota. And, you know, this is some major litigation waiting to happen. Then again, you know, certainly to look at the complexity of the rules. One of the things that I do after an election is that I make voluminous public records requests, and it's not just to be a pain in the behind for you. It's really to start to look at what happened, what went right in the election, but also what went wrong in the election. And one of the things that I consistently ask for are the poll worker comment sheets. Some call them booth worker sheets, whatever they are, because those sheets are very, very telling. Poll workers will tell you exactly what is going on at the polls on election day. I mean, they will tell you more than that you want to know. Sometimes they tell us things that we definitely don't want to know. But in many instances, they will definitely talk about the issue of provisional ballots. And I can tell you, page upon page upon page of the documents that I reviewed for 2006 indicated that the provisional ballots were the big elephant in the room, that they were complex, and in some instances, the poll workers basically said, I don't understand it. I'm just going to give them a provisional ballot and let them figure it out at the Board of Elections whether or not they're supposed to count that provisional ballot. You know, that is extremely troubling, especially when it comes down to an instance of a voter casting a provisional ballot in the wrong precinct. While I know and recognize that in 2008, the number one reason for provisional ballots being cast were voters not registered, and we can talk about that also, but the number two reason, again, was wrong precinct. However, that wasn't the case in 2006. 2006, the wrong precinct was the big elephant in the room, but more importantly, it's not only about wrong precinct, it's even breaking down wrong precinct to the point of saying, how many of those wrong precinct ballots were cast in the right polling place? In other words, right church, wrong pew is the way that we like to refer to it. And I think that that's very, very troubling because the Ohio law is very clear that a poll worker has the responsibility to direct the voter to the correct polling place and to inform them if they do not go, then you will cast a provisional ballot that will not count. There's certainly arguments as to what that basically means and whether or not poll worker, whether that constitutes poll worker error. And I hope that we get to the point today of coming out with some language that defines what poll worker error is. But I will tell you, in one of the reports that I received from one of the larger counties in Ohio, there were page upon page this year in 2008 of what the boards of elections found to be poll worker error when with regards to the provisional ballots that were cast. I mean, these were on Excel spreadsheets, and the reasons that the provisional ballot was cast page upon page was poll worker error. So how do we get around that, and how do we define that? Obviously, there's a different definition that's happening maybe in this county that opposed to other counties, because I'll tell you that the other counties did not provide that information to me. The lawsuit that came out, the decision that came out in 2008 from Judge Marbley that really basically said that provisional ballots should not be rejected based on poll worker error, I think we have to really start to define actually what does that basically mean. Finally, when we talk about provisional ballots being cast for not registered, actually, I trained attorneys in the state of Ohio, so I had attorneys all over the state. There were also we had a major hotline that we were engaged with, and I cannot tell you the amount of not only voters who called in, but poll workers who called in and said, this person has voted at this precinct for the last 10 years. And they are no longer registered on this book. Now, we can argue that maybe basically they were removed for list maintenance, but keep in mind that list maintenance only requires you to remove a person if, in fact, they have not voted in two federal elections and that there has been no communication with the boards of elections. So therefore, if they voted previously, there was no reason that they should have been removed. So something happened with voters. And I'm not saying in every instance it happened, but something has happened and voters have been dropped off the rolls. And that's a reality. And I don't want to sit here and start to live under some illusion that every voter who showed up just basically blew off for the last 2 years one of the most important elections for many people in their lifetime and basically didn't register. So I think we need to start to look at some of the other problems that are the reasons for these provisional ballots. And I do agree with voter responsibility, but also we need to weigh the burden on who really has the responsibility once the voter has done everything that they are required to do, which is to get out to vote, to get to the correct polling place, and then be directed in the same polling place to the wrong precinct. And so with that, I'm going to turn it over to Norman, and I'm looking forward to a lively interchange.
Thank you, Dania. Dr. Robbins.
Thanks. I'll be brief because I'm anxious to hear what everybody else here is going to say, but I'll just stick to a few starting points. The first is there seems to be universal agreement. There was in the poll worker training and in other surveys that we've got to simplify the laws. It's just unworkable. People with these new the poll worker training materials that the Secretary of State have made available, or organizations like the Cuyahoga County people who I work with. As an election reformer, they have tried all sorts of things, and with varying success. It's very tough to counter laws that are so confusing. That is not, as long as the laws stay this confusing, I would predict that no amount of of reasonable, affordable poll worker training is going to ameliorate the problem. As I mentioned in the poll worker training group, the numbers for provisional ballot rejections have not changed since 2000 at least. The same level of rejections have occurred, and although sometimes it's the two biggest causes for rejection are always wrong precinct and not registered. That accounts in general for about 90% or so, or 80% of provisional ballot rejection. So I'm hoping that at this session that we will deal with those two problems, because they are major, major, major. They keep coming up, and there are different solutions to each of those problems. And I'll emphasize something that, in fact, Professor Foley talked about, especially in the December summit, which is, I think a lot of this can be cured, as it were, with very little cost and a lot of savings because of all the time it takes all of you who are election officials to process provisional ballots. So I think this is an area where there could be substantial, at least a washout, if not substantial. And we can get into those kind of details later. But prevention of provisional ballots, I think, could be very, very cost effective. Just the very last thing is that the third, whatever is the third cause, because that varies, but since we've had the ID rules in 2006, there were about 2,700 people whose provisional ballots were rejected for ID. That's to be compared to the to these numbers like 14,000, 19,000 of these two major reasons that we saw in 2008. So it's a much smaller number, but I do raise the question if, and in 2008 it was about 2,000 people whose provisional ballots were rejected for ID problems. I raise the question, if it is true that there were only, in one study, 4 cases of voter fraud out of 9 million votes cast. This is the League of Women Voters study with COHIO. If that is the case, 4 cases of voter fraud out of 9 million cast, and yet we're seeing, as we saw in 2008, 2,000 voters who may, we don't know all the facts, who may have been disenfranchised, aren't we dealing with a very disproportionate balance between what we all have to deal with, which is the security of the vote versus enfranchising people? Thanks.
Thank you. Well, now we'd like to open up the discussion. You are all now panelists. A few housekeeping things, though. We do have a sign-up sheet that's going around. I'm not sure where it is now, but just keep that going around. We'd like to keep a record of who's in each session, and so I appreciate that. We passed out an agenda, which we will kind of be working off of. If you don't have it, we have some field reps, regional liaisons in the back of the room who can help you out. It'll just kind of serve as a skeleton for our discussion here. I'm not saying if you have a specific issue you'd like to discuss with a panelist, or if one of our panelists has something they want to interject, we're certainly open to that as well. And one last item, there's a microphone here in the middle of the room. Anyone who wants to offer a comment or a question, I just ask that you make your way over to the microphone, because we are recording this so that we can make it a permanent part of our study of this summit. So why don't we start with our first part of our agenda, which we've kind of talked about, and going back to our December election summit, it was pretty clear that there was almost universal agreement that provisional voting laws are too complex and extremely difficult for poll workers. And as Dr. Robbins pointed out in our previous session on poll worker training, lots of people talked about how difficult that was for poll workers. So why don't we just start with the first one, which Danita mentioned as well. This is just a proposed solution, and we can offer it for discussion, but if anyone, again, wants to make their way to the mic, they can do so. Should we eliminate or modify the wrong precinct law? Currently, a provisional ballot cast in a wrong precinct can't be counted, even if the voter is in the right polling location, but the wrong precinct line. Many elections experts agree that many thousands of provisional ballot rejections can be avoided by simply remaking or counting ballots cast in a voter's county of registration Other states have been doing this routinely for years. Does anyone have a comment, would like to make a comment on that just to start us off? Or?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I strongly support this reform in either of its two versions. One is eliminating this rule completely, or the less drastic version is the one that Danita mentioned, which is the so-called, if you're in the right church, it doesn't matter if you're in the wrong pew, at least you're at the right polling place. I think there's several values to this reform. One is just enfranchising voters. Remember, the underlying fact, we would only count their ballot, of course, for races for which they're eligible, right? I mean, so a statewide office or an office where they're located within the correct congressional district. We're not talking about counting their votes for something that they're not entitled to vote for. So they you can consider them substantively valid voters, but for the mistake of the polling place that they were at in the wrong precinct. So there's a positive, so there's no issue of fraud here, right? This is not an issue of a nefarious person who is trying to fraudulently defeat the system. They are someone who is entitled to vote for president or governor, but they messed up or the system didn't work for them. You know, the plus is it helps them to count, to enfranchise them, make them part of democracy to the extent that they're able. But the other administrative value is anything that we can do in Ohio to reduce the total number of provisional ballots from the over 200,000 that we have, which is an outlier nationally, and to reduce that exposure, it both saves money, as was mentioned, but it also avoids serious problems in a close election. Again, echoing off of Minnesota, in a close statewide race, large numbers of provisional ballots are, you know, it's what the lawyers are just like, you know, moths to the light bulb are just going to go straight for those provisional ballots to litigate if there are too many of them. And this is a strategic way simply to reduce that number to avoid a problematic exposure, as well as enfranchising people.
Did you comment?
My question is, not really a question, but a statement. We used to have home precinct rule. And, well, we do? Anyway, it's where you could, you know, if they voted in the right church, wrong pew, you could redo that so that everything that they voted on that was in their jurisdiction would get counted. So I think the laws what need to be changed, not because that's what makes the provisional vote not count, is the law, not us. But
right.
And the other thing is some of the other laws they have, like if a voter notification card gets returned to us, which we have gobs of those that get returned, they're supposed to vote provisional. You know, if you don't want that to happen, then you need to change the law. I mean,
that's a really good point. There's two points there. Why don't we take the first one, which is, you know, changing the law, which we're kind of on right now about home precinct. But there's also a good point there as well about, you know, the laws we have in Ohio about sending out the notification card and getting a return notification. There are many reasons you could have that happen to you. Anyone would like to comment on that one?
I'm sorry. I'll just say something about your comment, which is that the law needs to be changed. One of the arguments, I testified in front of the Ohio House Committee several years ago when they were considering again this wrong precinct law, and a couple of legislators on both sides of the aisle said, well, if we let people do that, they'll take advantage of it, and they won't be voting as much as they should on these local issues and weighing in. They'll just walk in any old place. And so I said, well, let's see what the experience is elsewhere. And I went to Pennsylvania, where they have a rule that that if you're in the wrong precinct, you vote at the higher level. I forget whether it's county or just below county, at which it doesn't matter whether you're in the wrong precinct or not, and everything above that. For state and federal. And it turned out that the number of voters in Pennsylvania who voted this kind of transitional ballot that they called, which they fix up and then count, was proportionately exactly the same as the number of provisional ballots we rejected in Ohio for wrong precinct. In other words, people in Pennsylvania who've had this for years were not voting in large numbers at the wrong place intentionally or out of laziness. And I also talked to the people in the Secretary of State's there, and they said, well, there was, of course, some transitional problems getting used to it, but now all the election officials are okay with it.
I agree with you. You're absolutely right. There has to be legislative change on this. There's nothing that can happen under the provisional ballot rules that are not going to happen with regards to, unless it's legislative change, because it is the Ohio Revised Code. But keep in mind, in 2004, we litigated the issue of defining what jurisdiction meant. And while the National Voter Registration Act of 1996 defined jurisdiction as county, Ohio defined jurisdiction as precinct. And had we have won that lawsuit, which we were fighting in 2004 to expand what the definition of jurisdiction was, we would not be having probably this argument in terms of wrong precinct ballots being thrown out. We would have been really looking at the provisional ballots that were cast and figuring out how do we remake the ballot or cast or count the ballot, at least for those races for which the voter was actually entitled to cast a ballot. So, I mean, this is something that we have been really pushing for. We believe it's important. And, you know, let me just say that, you know, the most fundamental right we have in our country is the right to vote. And really, many people come, you know, believe that it's important enough to come out to do. Provisional ballots, to me, while 200,000 were cast, and we can say that those, you know, people got an opportunity to vote, a couple things I'd like to know is how many people cast a provisional ballot in 2008 who cast a provisional ballot in 2006, which means that 10 days after the fact, that ballot was counted. But if you wanted to count on election day, if you came out and you stood in those lines to count on election day, you didn't count because those 200,000 ballots did not make make any difference on election day for at least for the office of President of the United States. They were 10 days late, and therefore you really did not participate in the way in a meaningful way, and that's what we're trying to prevent.
Sure. If you just.
On election night is the unofficial count. That really, the official count is the one that counts, and that is the one that gives us the time to take time to process everything that happens through our office. And I think that people, whoever they happen to be, need to realize that it's the official count that counts, and we're putting so much pressure on the unofficial count, and quit putting so much pressure on people to, like, we had a little girl who voted twice in our county because one of the observers told her that she did wrong by voting provisional ballot. Now, she didn't do wrong because she knew, didn't change her address with us. She had to vote provisional. She didn't have a choice if she wanted to vote. But she let the observers talk her into or intimidate her into thinking her vote was not going to count, so she went back to her old precinct in 32. Lying, said she still lived there. So, you know, I mean, there's a lot of things you need to look at when you take into consideration trying to get the votes to count versus not counting, I think, or changing people's opinion about things, because the unofficial is just that, the unofficial. The official is the one.
Can I just say just one on the issue of legislation? And I totally agree with the point that we need new legislation on this specific issue of some kind and scope. What I don't want anyone to have the impression is that if we don't have legislation, somehow this issue will go away because the legislation on the books at least says what to do about the wrong precinct issue. Rich can help out, and there's some technical details on this that may be too much detail, but many of you know that there is this concept that's already in the federal lawsuit that's been filed, you know, since 2006 called the NEOC case, that if the reason a voter votes provisionally instead of a regular ballot is due to poll worker error, then the statute doesn't apply. The court order method of dealing with the provisional ballot applies. Now, what happened this year in 2008 is there was a kind of back and forth tug of war between the federal court and the Ohio Supreme Court about which judiciary would get the last word on the counting rules. As a practical matter, this year, the Ohio Supreme Court got the last word because when the court issued the Supreme Court issued its decision in the Skaggs case that said you can't count these specific 1,000 ballots because they didn't follow certain rules, et cetera, and we're not going to treat it as poll worker error. The litigants took a wait-and-see attitude. Okay, let's just see what happens when we open the other envelopes and not open those 1,000. It turned out that doing that put the congressional race, the Kilroy-Stivers race, outside the margin of an automatic recount. Quite a number of people were surprised at that. They thought it would trigger an automatic recount, but it didn't. So that meant, for the practical matter, in 2008, the lawsuit went away. Had an automatic recount been triggered, they would have gone straight back into federal court in the NEOC case and not accepted the Ohio Supreme Court as the last word. And in fact, the litigants are back in front of the federal judge getting ready for 2010 as to what the rules will be for counting provisional ballots. And there's already been briefs filed since our December summit about enforcing the federal court order and nullifying the state Supreme Court order on a forward-going basis. What does that all mean for all of us as a practical reality? It means huge question mark. None of us really know the rules because the state court and the federal court are fighting each other about what the rules are and what to do with this concept of poll worker error and does that affect the counting of the ballots. So legislation, if nothing else, could clarify and take away some of the reasons why people go to court and fight over these things.
Rich.
Sure, go ahead.
Just a couple things. First of all, yeah, Ned is right. After the Ohio Supreme Court decision came down, and for the folks in the room who are interested in following all of this, that's the State Ex Rel Skaggs versus Bruner case. After that decision came down, in which the Ohio Supreme Court said that no, as a matter of Ohio law, these 1,000 votes, which did not have signatures in the right place on the ballot envelopes or didn't have the printed name properly on the provisional ballot envelopes or didn't have both, the argument there was whether or not that was poll worker error. We weren't really talking in this particular case about the wrong precinct rule. We were talking about errors to the manner in which the provisional ballot envelopes were filled out. After the federal court said, yep, that's all poll worker error, you count all of it, the Ohio Supreme Court said, nope, none of that is poll worker error. These are all mandatory duties that rest with the voter, so don't count these ballots. Now, the plaintiffs in the NEHOC case, Northeast Ohio Coalition for the Homeless case, have all asked the federal judge to enjoin the Ohio Supreme Court's rule. So basically what I'm telling you is, you know, stay tuned. We'll find out from the federal court whether or not the Ohio Supreme Court had the last word. The other thing, I just wanted to quickly address a point you had made about the voter notification cards, the 60-day mailers. That provision in Ohio...
No, send the registration cards.
No.
Oh, I'm sorry.
We send out when they register or change their address. Or
okay, you were talking about that. I thought you were...
Voter notification.
Okay.
Election notification.
Okay, I'm sorry, I misunderstood. I do, though, as long as I was going to mention this, I do want to let everybody know that the 60-day notice in Ohio law is done after the 08 general election, so that may, by sunsetting that provision, that may cut down on some of the provisional ballots also.
Thank you. Robbie?
I would just like to ask on the statistics on the 3 times rejection of the Florida voter or the Florida provisionals and 3 times the Missouri. How many reasons are there in Florida and Missouri and the national level to vote a provisional ballot? You said we have so many more rejections than we had. we have so many more reasons for someone to vote. There's 14 reasons to vote a provisional ballot. And also, I would like to say, you know, we could get the attorneys out of this and everything if voters would
no offense,
just
Rich.
Take responsibility for their own vote. If you move, you have to notify the telephone company, the cable company, the post office. I mean, you have to notify everybody in your life. Why not insist? You know, I mean, the easier you make something, the less valuable it becomes. And I think people don't feel that they have to change their addresses because, oh, they'll let me vote anyway. Well, and then they cry because their ballot isn't counted.
Ned, do you want to address the numbers question
yes,
first?
Sure. It's absolutely right, and part of the reason, I think a lot of us would just repeat each other and say ditto, 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 because we're in agreement on a lot of things. So we've tried to divide up some of the points and have us take it from different angles. But I agree with this notion that our law is too complex. And it's just unenforceable as intended just because of its complexity. And that 14 categories, I don't know of any other state that has a law that has, you know, the 14 categories that we have and has the mind-numbing complexity of Ohio's law. It doesn't have to be this way, right? Other states that are patriotic members of the union seem to run elections without the mind-numbing complexity that we have. Now, just on the point about registration portability, I guess my inference, I agree with you on the problem, the diagnosis. My medicine would be a little bit different, I think, than yours in terms of the problem is that we use provisional ballots in Ohio to allow for this updating your registration, change of address idea. Turns out that other states let folks cast a regular ballot instead of a provisional ballot if they're updating their voter registration at a new location. Missouri is a good example of this. Now, if it turned out that Missouri had a greater incidence of voter fraud than Ohio, I would think this would be a bad move, because I do think it is legitimate to be concerned about the casting of invalid ballots. I think that's a legitimate concern. And so I don't want to see a reform cause there to be more unlawful ballots cast. But Missouri is a state that has been attentive to this issue. They don't ignore this problem, and yet they're able to run their system without an undue incidence of fraud, and they can adopt a mechanism that allows for registration portability in a way that reduces the need to rely on provisional voting. Now, there may be reasons why we can't adopt their rule. We don't have to look at that. But at least it puts it on the agenda for me as something, hey, maybe another state is achieving all the good things that we want, not causing any problems that we don't want, and doing that in an easier, more efficient, less expensive way. That sounds like a win-win solution to look at. And again, it turns out that Missouri is one of those states that seems to not have the degree of our problem, which is having to reject as many ballots as we have to reject because of the complexity of our system.
Dr. Robbins?
Yeah, I'd just say quickly, I think what we need to do, though, is to break up this problem into the pieces. Like, for instance, what Ned Foley was just talking about are most of the provisional ballots that are cast for people moving and that are accepted, the 80% that are accepted, right? So that's one piece of this puzzle. Then another piece is the wrong precinct problem, another, which is a large problem, as I said before, and the other almost equally large problem, or is sometimes larger, is not registered. The not registered problem, which we'll get to if we have time, has about five different components to it, and so to deal with. So I think, and then there's still one other problem we referred to. I'm just trying to get things clear what we're talking about. The other thing that we have talked about a lot is the complexity, whether some of these rules, aside from dealing with the wrong precinct and not registered, et cetera, can be streamlined and simplified so they're really easy to understand. As one of the speakers in the poll worker session said, checklists work beautifully in terms of medical care and avoiding medical malpractice, I guess. And he said, if you can come up with just six things that a poll worker has to check off, that's the goal. And I thought that made a lot of sense.
Yes, ma'am.
Would it be possible to add U.S. Postal Service as a place where people could register to vote, change their addresses? That way, when they change their address at the post office could mail that to the Board of Elections?
I'll make a quick comment, unless anybody else does. I will say that we did a pilot project at the Ohio Secretary of State's office this year in which we worked with, I think, several either zip codes or postal service locations where when a family or someone who is moving got their packet from the U.S. Postal Service on change of address, there were two voter registration cards included in that packet. And we actually, I think from the results of that, I think it went pretty well, but it was, again, just a pilot project, but something that we might want to talk about. I don't know if anyone has to comment on the U.S. Postal Service or that one. Dania?
I will just comment. I'm sorry. Did you want to go?
Oh, no, go ahead. I was just directing her to the microphone. Sorry.
Oh, okay. No, I would just comment that pilot program I read up on and thought it was an excellent way to, because all of us are not going to often frequent, you know, social service agencies or, you know, we often, you know, how often do we really have to update our driver's license and things like that? But that's something that if you move, I mean, if you move, period, you know, you're going to get that, those voter registration forms. And again, we really, you know, the goal here today to me is to really come up with, you know, out of the box responses and solutions. I mean, we know what the problems are, and we know who's being disenfranchised and who's being enfranchised. But you know, the issue is, I think the big elephant is really how do we fix these problems? I really have to say that I agree with Ned when he talks about the change of address and, you know, voting a regular ballot as in Missouri. So what is the issue? And I'd like to hear from, you know, maybe, you know, election officials. What is the issue if a person shows up with the correct ID? Because now we have ID, shows up with the correct ID, is in the correct polling place, changes their address, and what is the problem with voting a regular ballot opposed to a provisional ballot? I'm not quite understanding why it has to be a provisional ballot.
It's a valid question. Ma'am, did you have a question? Make a comment? Could you hit the microphone real quick? Hold on a second, Scott. She had her hand up for a while.
I wanted to answer her question.
Oh, hold on then.
Well, first of all, when they go, you know, if we had the electronic poll books or whatever, that would be fine. But if someone comes to my polling location, I live in Claremont County, and they're coming from Franklin County, moving into our county, I don't have the records whether they're properly registered somewhere else or not. So what you're saying is you're going back to same day registration almost, but you know, there's no way to, you know, unless you had a state poll book to do that in that method. But I just wanted to make a quick comment with regards to people not updating their address, and that is we have done a poor job on our part. We've been great getting these people registered, but when have we ever put the onus on them and told them, hey, if you move and change address, you need to update your records with us? Because I can name you thousands of people who are out there registering people every day, but no one ever says, hey, it's your responsibility to update your information if you move or change your name. We need to start getting this out. And I got one last little comment that Ned made, and he kept saying this over and over, which bothered me. He kept saying that anybody that votes provisional is disenfranchised. I don't think they're disenfranchised. We are giving these people a chance to get up to speed and to vote, so I don't see that they're disenfranchised. And I know a lot of people have, oh, I don't want to vote provisional. You know, well, then you should have updated your address or you should have updated your name. You know, the official count is what counts,
But, you know, maybe that is the perception, because Election Day is the perception of the count. But maybe, we need to re-educate. The official count is the official count. So if they have to vote provisional, that onus is back on them. But I still feel we have neglected a little bit when we register these people to tell them, hey, it's now your responsibility to update your information with us.
Let's let Ned respond, then we'll go to Scott. Ned.
Yeah, I want to be clear. I do not believe in any way at all that simply voting a provisional ballot is a form of disenfranchisement. Just the opposite. I think the concept of a provisional ballot is a very worthwhile concept. It is this notion of a safety net to protect the voter. What I'm concerned about is, so if I gave you that impression, that's not at all what I want to say. What I'm concerned about several things. One is, again, exposure to costly and destabilizing litigation, which I don't think anybody likes or needs. But secondly, I am concerned about rejected provisional ballots, wondering whether or not those ballots, and it's not simply the question whether they were properly rejected under the law, it's whether the legal regime is causing someone to vote a provisional ballot that ends up not getting counted when a different legal regime could have allowed them to vote a regular ballot so that specific subcategory of voters is not disenfranchised. Because it's not that any provisional voter is disenfranchised, it's the provisional ballots that get rejected by definition don't count, and there were 40,000 individuals in Ohio who meet that test. Now, if that's 40,000 individuals who were trying to steal the election and were nefarious, well, then those ballots shouldn't be counted. But I don't think we have the data that proves that. I think the more likely hypothesis, which could be disproved, is these are 40,000 people who wanted to participate in this most incredibly historic election of 2008, and somehow were caught up in the system, and their effort to participate was frustrated. Now, do we need to accept 40,000 of our? Think about how many towns in Ohio have 40,000 people in it. And 40,000 people, their votes were wiped out. How many of those votes should have been wiped out? How many of those votes didn't have to be wiped out if we had a different regime that would have let them vote a regular ballot?
Scott, you want to respond to Denise's question?
Yeah, I'm going to take a slightly contrarian and probably an unpopular stance, perhaps, during this seminar. But I'm going to say the mess that we're in is pretty much the result of academics and lawyers have brought us to the situation that we're in. That's my first comment. The second comment is, yes, we all agree that everyone should be seeking the greatest number of enfranchised persons, but why should the rest of us suffer for the inability of others to follow what the rules are on registration? We don't get special consideration because we just decide to come off the street and show up at whatever precinct. I can show you, I'm a manager of registration in a large county here in Ohio, and I can show you instance after instance where we just have an individual shows up wherever they want. We have people that they've mentioned before have voted year in, year out provisionally. We update their addresses. They continue to do it. This is not always a rational process that can be dealt with through legislation or through our laws. We just have to recognize that there are always going to be a situation where there are going to be people that are not going to be able to vote through their own efforts. Nobody in the state of Ohio that's eligible has to be disenfranchised. Everyone that's eligible that meets the requirements can vote if they follow the law. It's as simple as that.
I got
Hold on. Do you have a question, Scott? Or?
Yeah, my last comment is, I'd like to ask the panel, what efforts are they looking at to end the endless cycle of provisional voting? Shouldn't we be looking at civic education where we teach students how to correctly vote? Shouldn't we show people, well, I mean, even a greater thought, and I've gone over this with my director and my coworkers day in, day out, we can't even get voters to fill in an oval. How are we gonna get them to understand provisional voting? This is a problem, this is a solution looking for a problem.
Thank you, Scott. I do want to say just one thing, though, before I let Ned respond. I know this is a sensitive subject and everything, but let's try and keep respectful of our panelists and everyone involved in the discussion. Ned?
I'm a big fan of civic education, so amen, hallelujah. The more civic education, the better. So I'm on board for that. I guess the only thought that I want to share is it seems to me that registration has an instrumental value, right? Registration is not an end in itself, right? Registration is a tool that we use to make our voting process better. And we need to ask whether or not registration is working as that tool, or is it not working to make the voting process better for the citizenry, the voters. If it is, fine. If it's not, maybe let's refine the tool and make it better. I do think that it is absolutely true, as the last couple of comments have said, that the only way we're really going to solve the problem of provisional voting is through registration reform. Some things we can do, like the wrong precinct rule, and we can make it simpler and maybe make ID laws less complex. But if we're really going to tackle this beast, it's going to be through an updated voter registration system. And I know that's another topic for another panel. But we also, in Ohio, need to be aware that Congress is looking at this as well as Ohio. And whether we like it or not, or whatever our own philosophy is on voter registration, as we think about 2010 and 2012, we in Ohio may be implementing new national legislation on voter registration reform. Do we want to be parties to that national debate? Do we want to help shape congressional thinking on this? Danita talked about ways to think outside of the box. You know, Arizona has online voter registration, not online voting. You can't vote by internet. But you can register by internet if the state government already has a signature on file through DMV or some other agency. Washington State is looking at that. It might be that we could deal with this change of address form much more easily if voters could update their voter registration information online. Maybe we could kick out to voters an email message if we, you know, if the governments were to learn from DMV or the post office or some other electronic mechanism that a voter has changed their address, maybe that could trigger an email to the voter saying, hey, your voter registration is not updated. Can you confirm your new address? And it may be that we can achieve all the values that we want of making sure the lists are accurate and that the voters take a certain degree of responsibility for the accuracy of their own information, but without having undue hassle, because we can do this more efficiently electronically. So I think we can look for some innovative solutions that will make everybody feel like the process is working better and that the tool is a useful tool.
Danita?
Yes, I'd just like to weigh in and say, you know, I graduated in 1974 from Columbus South High School. And one of the courses that I was required to take was Problems of Democracy. And it taught me about civic engagement. It taught me about being a good citizen. It also taught me how important it was to exercise my right to vote. And those courses no longer exist. They've been cut because of funding and because other people felt that it was not as important. And so, you know, one of the areas, certainly I would agree with civic, you know, education, but I also think that it really could start at a high school level, especially as we ask more high school students to become engaged in the process. That's one of the first things that I'd like to add. And I think that we have started to talk about solutions here, and that's, you know, to solutions in terms of looking at the wrong precinct and asking ourselves, is it a rule that really moves the ball forward, or in some ways does it prevent voters who have done everything that they possibly can Also, I'd like to throw out in the event, I mean, I always believe going for the entire pie, but, you know, I'm willing to take a piece here and there. One of the pieces is that in some states, you cannot cast a provisional ballot in the wrong precinct that is rejected. I mean, the law is that if it is cast in the right precinct, no matter even if you don't cast at the right table, I mean, in the right polling place, that provisional ballot is going to count. And so therefore, to me, that is a piece of the pie. It's not the piece that I would want, but it's certainly, you know, at least one recommendation that we can start to look at, and maybe we can move forward and get more, certainly more, a larger piece of the pie, but at least to start somewhere, that could possibly save us 10,000 votes in an election.
Jeff.
Thank you. I just want to start by saying that I'm a little disappointed that on this important topic we don't have any election official representation on the panel, because we do have some perspectives that on this subject that do play into the overall solution. I've been hearing about the system being not, or the system failing someone, or this is needing cured and that needing cured. But you know, when somebody's not registered, that shouldn't go into your disenfranchisement statistics, because that's a choice that they make. Just like some people don't vote for every race or every candidate, they make a choice not to be registered. There's actually a form that they can file where they say that. Now, and let's get back to this, the comment about the system not or if the system failing somebody because we get a returned notification. You know, like we change a poll location, we send them a postcard. Chances are, and I, you know, we can play around with a 1 or 2%, but chances are the vast majority of those people don't live there when there's something bounced back. The system works. I seem to always get all my bills mailed, delivered to my house. You know, the system does work. They don't live there. So that's why they're flagged. And it isn't, you know, I think that sometimes it gets to be, it's falling on the boards of elections to have to defend themselves about these high rates. We are following the law. We are following the evidence in front of us. If somebody is not registered, what can we do? They've self-disenfranchised, and that should not be in the statistics.
Thanks, Jeff.
I'd like to respond.
Okay.
We're running out of time, and we haven't addressed the equally large cause of provisional ballot rejections, which you just brought up, which is the voters being, quote, not registered. I think it is, I've done some research, and there isn't time to go through all of this, but it is not the case that 19,000 people went to the polls in 2008 and were listed finally as not registered and their votes rejected. I worked on the materials thanks to the help of people at the Cuyahoga County, and for instance, we found that people were getting dropped from the rolls, and ahead of the election, they showed up, they were listed as not registered, and their votes were rejected. This is, well, I'll give you this, I'll give you a reference. I'd be very happy to have you look at the data, which is at the Greater Cleveland Voter Coalition website, clevelandvotes.org. Go look at some of the reports, and you will see the data from 2004. You don't like that data? I'm sorry, that's the data. Now, what I'm saying is that that I don't believe in having an antagonism with voting officials. I work, there are a couple of people in this very room from Cuyahoga County who know me very well. I have great relations with them. We're working right now with Betty Edwards right over, sitting over there, on following up some of the registration problems. I really resent the idea that people say, oh, it's those advocates. I say it's just the opposite. If people on boards of election are willing to work with people like myself, we love it because we get more information as to what's going on and have ideas and input. And I think, I don't know if Jane Platten is here, But she will tell you that some of the information that we've been able to work through collectively has led to the enfranchisement, in one case, of 1,400 voters in Cuyahoga County. So please do not go away from this meeting thinking that there's some kind of antagonism here. We both want the same thing. I know those people from Cuyahoga County. They are extremely dedicated, and the ones that I've met from other counties are equally dedicated. I don't have the least bit of antagonism towards them. I want to work with them. But what I think I can contribute, and people like me here on the panel, is we can have a different perspective. Some of us are out there at stores registering voters, seeing what's going on. Some of us crunch numbers because we have a science background, and we're glad to bring them to people. So please don't make this a difference. We're in it together. We're trying to help, and I hope you really understand that. That is extremely important.
We have time for one more question, if it's okay.
Yeah, but I also need just to clarify that at The Ohio State University, we are not an advocacy organization at all. We do not litigate at all. That's our policy. We believe at the state university, we're part of the state system. Our perspective, if it exists, is one of improved public administration and how to improve public administration. And on this point, the only thing that I would say about this category of almost 20,000 individuals who they have to sign a statement under penalty of election falsification that they think that they are registered. Now, of course, they could be wrong about that. They might never have submitted a registration form. They might never have attempted. All that we're thinking about as academics is thinking about what's the disconnect that would cause someone actually to take the effort to go to the polls. Because after all, our turnout rates in Ohio are lower than some other states, and we always like to increase turnout, you know, assuming that it's proper individuals who are turning out. And so we encourage voter participation. So we have some people who are casting ballots who think that they are qualified to do so, and yet the system is telling them that they're not registered. I'm not attributing any kind of fault or blame to that, whether it's in any way. I'm just concerned about that disconnect.
Right. We have time for one more question. Go ahead, ma'am.
Hi, my name is Debbie Quivy, and I'm the director in Athens County. And I agree, we are all in this together, so we do want to work together at it. So I'm going to speak only for my county on this, though. We really try to do everything we can to educate our poll workers and try to make provisionals count. We only had not quite 7% of our provisionals did not count this time. We were very proud of this. When people were not registered to vote, what we did was we were told to make a copy of the envelope because that envelope, that ballot didn't count. It had to be sealed in that envelope and it'll be destroyed in 22 months. We made a copy of it. We made a registration card. We sent a card out. We had 63 people. We wrote it in red. We identified it when it would come back into the office. We sent it to 63 people. Not one of them bothered to sign it and send it back to us. So what do we do? How much farther do we go?
Anyone like to respond to that one? That'll be our last question of the day. All right. Did anyone have any final comments they wanted to make? Or
I would just like to, my final comment really, again, has to do with, you know, how do we move the ball forward. I'd just like to tell you, while I understand that, you know, the mass transportation system in Ohio is nowhere near some of the other states, but one of the things that we do in New Jersey, I work in Washington, live in New Jersey from Columbus, Ohio, but in any event, in New Jersey is that a voter has an opportunity to go before a judge on election day. On election day in Ohio, in New Jersey, the only judges on the bench are judges who hear election cases. They don't need attorneys. I know you're happy about that. They do not need attorneys. They just go in and they are able to present to the judge any information or documentation that they have at that time to show that they duly either registered or attempted to register, whether it's a social service agency or wherever. At that point, the judge makes the determination and tells and allows the voter either to cast a regular ballot or a provisional ballot. ballot. And I'm telling you, that has substantially reduced the number of provisional ballots in the state of New Jersey just by voters coming in. And I actually, in 2008 on the primary, since it was a different day than Ohio, had the opportunity to be there to represent voters pro bono. And I couldn't believe the amount of people who felt so strongly about casting a regular ballot that they found a way to get down to the court. And actually, the court was actually in the county board of elections, and were able to really put forth an argument. And almost 99% of those voters cast regular ballots.
Okay. I mean, the only thing that again I would say from the perspective of public administration in Ohio, I don't like it when I'm proud to be from Ohio, and I want our state to be thought of well around the country. And again, going around the country these days, people compare Minnesota to Ohio, for example, and Ohio gets lumped with Florida right now is how not to run elections, unfortunately, and other states get talked about is, well, that's the right way to do things. I'd like it in the future people say Ohio is the way to run elections. You want to look at the gold standard of how to run elections? Come to Ohio. Ohio is the gold standard, not any other state. We're the gold standard. That's what I would like for my state, our state. I'm very afraid, and it's not the fault in any way of local officials. This is an issue for our General Assembly to address, I think. But I'm very afraid that Ohio will be the subject of the national spotlight again, as it has been. And we've come close to where provisional ballots has caused a monumental train wreck in a presidential race. It hasn't happened, thank goodness, because the races haven't been close enough in 2004 or 2008. But we're also increasing our reliance on provisional voting. We're not decreasing. So whenever we increase the volume of provisional ballots, we increase the risk of that train wreck, not through any fault of anybody at all, but the point at which a presidential election gets caught up in a fight over Ohio's provisional voting system, that will be when we're not the gold standard, we're the lead standard, we're the laughing stock, and I don't want us to be the laughing stock. And that risk is still in the system, even though we've been lucky enough to escape the consequences of that vulnerability. And I don't want us to go into the next election having that vulnerability, having to gamble that we're lucky enough that the race isn't close. Because at some point in time, if we keep gambling, we'll lose that bet. And I don't want to lose that bet.
Well, a big thank you to our panel. Let's give them a round of applause. And thank you to all of you, and enjoy the rest of the conference.